It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here, and we have lots to talk about. Backspace is back, baby. Steve will explain. We'll also talk about Intel's CES announcement claiming their new processor can detect ransomware. Can it? Plus, Steve's got a new security scale. He calls it the Cheeto scale. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 801, recorded Tuesday, January 12th, 2021. Out with the old. Security Now is brought to you by Worldwide Technology and Cisco. When was the last time your company updated your security strategy? Are your business assets protected? WWT offers security solutions and services that will protect every endpoint of your business and help you combat the next-gen threats. Visit WWT.com/twit to get started. And by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at Barracuda.com/security now. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security online, your privacy, how things work, how bad it's getting, how good it's getting, all that stuff. With this guy right here, live long and prosper, Steve Gibson. Wait a minute, I got to put the thumb out, right? That's the key.
That's right. Thumb out.
Thumb out. And I can't do it with my left hand.
Do I have a show for us today?
What's the topic?
The title is Out with the Old, which was inspired after I got back into Spinrite 6's source code and realized how much crap was in there to deal with the things that we were having to deal with back in the 1980s and 90s at the beginning of the PC era. And so first it was just going to be kind of like, you know, just mention it. But I just think our listeners will really find it interesting. The old timers will be going, oh, I remember when DOS had a 33.5 megabyte partition size limit, believe it or not. And you know, younger viewers are going to be like, what? So anyway, we've got so much to talk about. We have critical updates for Firefox and all of the Chromium-based browsers, and a potentially unwelcome but reversible change coming to Firefox. We're going to look at another new tactic being employed by the ransomware gangs, or at least one of them, an update on ransomware's profitability, a bogus-seeming announcement from Intel, which was made yesterday during their CES announcement of the 11th-gen core processors. I did dig in to see if there was anything to it, and now listeners will be left with no question about how I feel. And we have the first use on this podcast of the term teledildonics.
Teledildonics. Get it right.
Dildonics. Oh, you're right. Sorry, Leo. Teledildonics.
As anybody knows.
Yes. Following that, we have some residual SolarWinds news. The formation of a security screw-up crisis management group. News of the inevitable attacks on Zyxel users. The mass exodus from WhatsApp following their plans to force all metadata sharing for users of their platform. A quick sci-fi note about The Expanse. And then, as I said, inspired by the amazing amount of old code I have rediscovered inside Spinrite, I'm going to take our listeners back to the roaring 80s with a look at how far we have come from DOS 3.3. And we do have a picture of the week for the ages. This is just so good. It came without caption, and I thought, that's a Cheeto. So, yeah.
That could mean a lot of things. Let's see. I got my T-bar stuck. Wait a minute. All right, good. All right, unstuck the T-bar. We've come a long way, baby. That's the name of the subtitle on this show. But before we get to that, let's talk about our sponsor, WWT Worldwide Technology. I love these guys at WWT. We went out. It was the last thing I did. So that trip to St. Louis will always have kind of a special extra weight. It was the last. It was March 2nd, I think, 2nd through the 4th, which was probably, in hindsight, a bad time to travel. But Lisa and I really wanted to see WWT's Advanced Technology Center, and I am so glad we did. And we met everybody over there, and what a great team in St. Louis. WWT. Now, their partner in this particular case is Cisco. We use a lot of Cisco security here. I'm not going to get too specific, but it's a really great tool. They're a great partnership. WWT offers you security solutions and services that'll help protect your business. And nowadays, boy, you need that. The question is, how prepared are you? It's the question I ask Russell. Actually, it's kind of a rephrasing of the question I ask our IT guy every time I see him is it safe? Is it safe? Are we okay? How prepared are you? Attackers are constantly updating their strategies. Ransomware is rampant more than ever before. You got to do more to protect yourself. You got to adapt. And that's why WWT is here to help you combat next-gen threats. You want a company that has the vision, the services, actually the capabilities to deliver security controls and reduce the risk for your organization. They could come in, they can give you an assessment, they can give you, you know, a blue team look at what's going on, a red team, you know, attack assessment. They are really good. WWT does everything you need to deliver security controls and reduce the risk in your business. Their team provides resources and platforms that make it possible. They've used it all. They know it all. They can help you find a solution that's perfect for your needs. And they've been doing this for more than 20 years. So they've got the track record. In fact, I'll give you a couple of examples. There's a whole bunch of them at their website, wwt.com/twit. I've mentioned this before. The healthcare, I won't say names, but the healthcare organization that was about to move to, as many are, electronic health record technology. And they wisely, I think very wisely, proactively said, we want to conduct a security risk assessment before we do this. We want to make sure everything's locked down. We want to protect our patients, our customers. WWT came in. Their consultants used their expert knowledge, state-of-the-art tools. They did an in-depth analysis. They even did training and repetition. And, you know, it's funny. The assessment came up with something that probably anybody who listens to this show would go, well, yeah. They found out that 90% of the vulnerabilities that they found in that system, 90% of them, could be fixed simply by putting in a comprehensive, systematic approach for patching, of course. And that's what they did. And it made a huge difference. They worked with a well-known retail bank, no names again, that wanted to build their infrastructure out so that they could survive, well, prevent in the first place. And if they couldn't prevent, survive a catastrophic security event. WWT helped them reduce system outages 40%, and they saved them huge amounts of money, cost savings of 48%. They did it with infrastructure automation. They know how to do that stuff. They can come in and really analyze the issues and help you find the right solution. That's what they do so well. Endpoint security, which helps you improve visibility and compliance, but defending at the edge. Network security protects your network traffic, decreases your attack surface, improves threat detection and response, and reduces cyber risk overall. Identity and access management. I mean, it's always important that the right people, only the right people have the access to the resources, and only at the appropriate time. They also help do something that is now kind of, I think, widely accepted as the way forward in security, zero trust architectures with segmentation. You know, even micro segmentation, strong identity management, a next gen security architecture. See how WWT can protect your business assets and intellectual property with a holistic security approach. So, I won't go on and on. WWT can help you. They're really great. They're super smart. You can bring them in. I think right now what you should do is go to wwt.com/twit and get started. Letting Worldwide Technology help you. I think you'll really find the answers you need. WWT.com/TWIT. Worldwide technology delivering digital outcomes and modernizing IT infrastructure all over the world from their home in St. Louis. And you got to check out the Advanced Technology Center. That's a mind blower. All right, Steve, I'm ready with the picture of the week. It does look like a Cheeto. So,
this is wonderful. What we have is an attempt to show by clear visual analogy the effect of security when your username is admin and your password is admin. In other words, it's probably weak. What the default was for the device that came with it versus a username of capital K, lowercase O, capital L, lowercase P, capital V, capital X, lowercase R, lowercase I, lowercase
that's
W.
Interesting.
That was just the user.
That's interesting.
Just a username.
Do you agree with that? Instead of, because most places use your email as the password. It would be, you know, why use something easily deduced?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, not using your email is definitely better. Of course, they do that because when you cannot remember that your password was set to capital I asterisk dollar sign lowercase j, double quote greater than question mark UI dollar sign 5, they need to be able to email you to your username a password recovery link. So, okay, so as by way of visual analogy, remember, I'm sure our users are familiar with this very simple slider kind of door lock where it's sort of there's a slider with a knob that rides in a slot. And when you in order to lock the door, you slide it over and the end of it goes into a hole cut in a plate. You know, it's like a very simple door lock. Well, that would be too secure if your username was admin and your password was admin. So in this picture, that sliding piece has been removed and a Cheeto has been inserted.
But Steve, it's a crunchy Flamin' Hot Cheeto.
which
your average Cheeto.
Better. It's a long, thin Cheeto, in order to perform its task. But it is probably a very good analogy for the equivalent security offered by leaving your username and password both set to their default. And by comparison, over on the right side, where, you know, it takes a minute to enunciate the username and password, we've got multiple redundant, all in parallel, different technologies, you know, just that door might as well not exist. It ought to just be a wall that runs right across there. So anyway, this came from a Twitter follower. Thank you so much for this. I happened to dig back into some of his earlier DMs to me, and I found it. I said, this is too wonderful. Yes, because the slider would be too secure. If it's admin, you need to put a Cheeto in there, Leo, and then it's about the right amount of security. So Firefox and Chromium have both already been patched for critical updates that were found in them. Of course, the two most important Chromium-based browsers are Chrome and Edge, but also pretty much everything else is Chromium now except for Safari. They all required, and it's nice to be able to use the past tense, updating to remove critical remote system takeover bugs. So these were bad. And, you know, this would be much bigger news if all of our browsers did not enjoy near real-time updating. And, in fact, a bit later we're going to see what's underway now with those Zyxel security endpoints we discussed last week, which do not auto-update. But in the case of Firefox, this is a 2020 CVE 16044 carrying the title Use After Free Write When Handling a Malicious Cookie Echo SCTP Chunk. And the description explains that a malicious peer could have modified a cookie echo chunk in an It's hard for me to pronounce this because I don't know. SCTP. It doesn't roll off the tongue. An SCTP packet in a way that potentially resulted in a use after free. They said, we presume that with enough effort, it could have been exploited to run arbitrary code. Now, we don't often talk about SCTP because I have a hard time pronouncing it. But it is the Stream Control Transmission Protocol, kind of a hybrid of UDP and TCP. And it was originally intended for use within the Telecommunication Signaling System 7, you know, SS7, that whole mess. And being a hybrid of UDP and TCP, it does run over UDP. So that's its underlying carrier envelope. But it still provides TCP's fault tolerance, reliable delivery, and in-sequence transport of messages, all which, as we know, are missing from UDP, which is just kind of best effort, and we're not sure when or if or in what order the packets are going to arrive. And like TCP and unlike UDP, it also handles congestion control. So basically, it's a sort of a light TCP. But unlike either of them, SCTP provides multi-homing and redundant paths to increase resilience and reliability. It was standardized by the IETF in RFC 4960. So it's a real thing. And although the first reference implementation appeared in FreeBSD 7, support for it is now widely present. In any event, the way Firefox uses it, each received SCTP packet contains a cookie chunk to facilitate a corresponding reply from the browser's cookie. A cookie echo chunk is a snippet of data sent during the initialization of the SCTP connection with the browser. And as Mozilla said, the implementation had a flaw that, given sufficient motivation, could be remotely abused. Mozilla didn't credit anyone with the discovery. We're not sure where it came from, nor did they state whether it was actively being exploited in the wild. You know, maybe they found it being abused and thought, ooh, let's fix this now. But given that our browsers are strict clients of servers, although Mozilla said nothing more, it sounds as though the perpetration of this attack would have required an evil server to send the malicious cookie echo chunk back to the browser. And this means that it would have required a watering hole attack, you know, drawing browsers, presumably a specific targeted individual, to a malicious site where this vulnerability would have been exploited. So, but the point being that it's not just something you could get easily. In any event, thanks to auto updating, we Firefox users are protected. On the Chromium side, the researchers at Tenable, who found and responsibly reported the bug to Google, believe that it's bad enough to rank it as critical, although both Google and Microsoft classify it as only high in severity. And it's unclear what the backstory is on this one, too. It's an out-of-bounds bug that was originally found and reported by Tencent Security Lab researcher Bohan Liu, who received credit for his work. But the bug dates back to a Chrome for Android security bulletin, which Google published in October of 2020, when it was also classified as only high severity after its discovery the month before in September. So it's a flaw in Chromium's V8 JavaScript and WebAssembly engine. At the time, the bug was also classified as high severity. It's identified as an out-of-bounds write in V8. And today, neither Microsoft nor Google explain why the October 2020 CVE, which is 15995 bug, has popped up again and apparently was just recently in need of fixing enough that all of our browsers got revved, you know, all the Chromium browsers. But in any event, that was one of an additional 12 Chromium bugs that were reported by Google with not surprisingly, a one-for-one duplication echoed by Microsoft. And it occurred to me that whoever it is over at Microsoft whose job it is to report bugs in Edge now has it very easy. They copy and they paste. They copy and they paste. Then they go to lunch because, you know, it's just Chromium bugs is all they're dealing with. The majority of the bugs, these 13 in total, were rated high severity and were predominantly use after free bugs, and they earned their respective discoverers or teams $20,000 each. So, you know, cool to report things responsibly. And as we've said, if you're good at doing this, you could maybe make it a career. Unlike the SCTP flaw that was fixed in Mozilla, which due to its nature requires a watering hole style attack, as I mentioned, vulnerabilities in the Chromium V8 engine are directly exploitable by code that's downloaded from any website, including from an instance of malvertising, even on a highly reputable site. So good that, you know, these things got found and removed by their, you know, found by the responsible reporters and then, you know, quickly revved. And again, you know, we're browsers, I guess they weren't first, right? Well, maybe they are, because like they're updating even more frequently than Windows. But this notion of anything connected needing to take responsibility for its own security, you know, that's clearly the model of the future. I would argue that browsers are the best at that because they're just doing it all the time. You know, Windows, due to the practical problems of breaking it, which is would, you know, cause IT people to lose their minds. It was the case once upon a time, right, Leo, that Windows would just be pushing updates at any time.
Yeah.
And that was causing such trouble that they said, okay, fine, you know, we'll aggregate them and only do them monthly.
Yeah. That was mostly for IT departments because, you know, individuals probably don't care as much, but IT departments really don't like updates, you know. So it's better if it's once a month.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, the question is, and this is a feature we're losing in Firefox, to change the page or stay where you are. 7 years ago, Blair McBride over at Mozilla opened a question about what Firefox's backspace key should do. He opened a Mozilla bug report, although it's not a bug, but you know the Bugzilla system is just the common way they manage all issues of any sort. And so at 7 years ago, he wrote, pressing backspace does different things depending upon where the cursor is. If it's in a text field, not surprisingly, it deletes the character to the left. If it's not in a text input field, it's the same as hitting the back button. Whether to keep this behavior has been argued, and then he has in all caps, for a very long time. It's confusing for many people, he suggests, but we've assumed it would break muscle memory for many people. However, the muscle memory argument was mostly an assumption. As far as I know, we didn't have a useful usage data, useful usage data until now. He says, so now we have or can get useful usage data to either back up the muscle memory argument or to squash it once and for all and remove backspace as a shortcut for navigation. Okay, this is 7 years ago. During the past 7 years, there has been a long and winding and storied thread accruing comments, observations, and opinions, and lots of feelings. Until 12 days ago, the issue was declared resolved, and the long outstanding question for Firefox's handling of the backspace key was at long last answered, or at least resolved. They wrote, we should not overload common user actions. And for those who are not familiar, overload is a term that comes out of object orientation, where you can put more functionality into an existing expression, which then uses the context of the expression to determine what it does. It's kind of cool, but it can also be confusing. And that's exactly the problem here. They're talking about overloading common user actions, meaning that the backspace key would be context dependent. Anyway, they said with backspace, it behaves as you would expect in one context, deleting text, but in another subtle context, text box not selected, it has a destructive action. Now, the reason they call it destructive is maybe you were filling in data in a form and you had a lot, you know, you'd worked at it for a few minutes, and then somehow the insertion point was not in the form, but you didn't realize that, and you hit backspace intending to remove a character that wasn't going to get removed, and that was interpreted by Firefox as hitting the back button, thus clearing, you know, stepping you back before you receive the form, losing all of that work. Thus, they call it destructive. That's what they mean. So they said this creates a high likelihood scenario for a common user behavior, deleting text, to trigger a less likely user behavior, which is using a keyboard shortcut to navigate back. They said this investment resolves the overloaded function and closes the gap on user behavior, which is a strange way of putting it. But they said Firefox is the only browser using the backspace key, meaning today, as a keyboard shortcut for navigating to the previous page on a tab. This was originally implemented to follow IE's behavior. We don't go to the previous page if you use the shortcut inside a text input. There are several reasons that make a good case for removal of the shortcut. And the argument to retain backspace keyboard shortcut from muscle memory for users migrating to Firefox or using Firefox along with another browser does not apply anymore. Edge has now replaced IE as a default Windows browser without a similar shortcut. And they mentioned that Alt left arrow is the only keyboard shortcut now available for this. Chrome also only implements Alt left arrow because, again, Chromium is common to both browsers. And they said Chrome had this shortcut and removed it because of user data loss risks. So they finish, the backspace key shortcut on Firefox is by far the keyboard shortcut with highest usage, with 40 million, and they use the abbreviation MAU, monthly active users, which is well above Find in Page, which actually I use a lot. That has 16 million monthly active users, or Page Reload, which is 15 million monthly active users. So this raises concerns that our users are suffering usability issues and data loss issues from hitting this keyboard shortcut by mistake. In other words, they can't determine whether it was deliberate or a mistake. So, but they're noticing it's getting hit a lot, 40 million, you know, more than search in a page or reload the page. So anyway, because backspace is so popular, and this podcast is a favorite among the more technically oriented, I would not be surprised to learn that a good percentage of those 40 million monthly active users who are using backspace to deliberately go back to the previous page might be listening to this podcast and suddenly be confused or annoyed to discover that its use for that purpose has finally come to an end. We're currently at Firefox 84. That is after those critical updates that I just mentioned. That brought us to 84. The change has been merged. This change in the handling of backspace has been merged into the Firefox Nightly 86 builds. So we can expect to see backspace's behavior being neutered once 86 makes it to the main release channel. The good news is that the Boolean setting for it can be turned back on. As usual, you put about:config into the URL of your Firefox browser and hit enter. That brings up a bazillion settings. You now have to agree to accept the awesome responsibility that accompanies making any changes behind the scenes, and then search for the string browser.backspace. one item will be found. It's browser.backspace_something. I don't even remember now what it was, but just search for browser.backspace and you'll find it. The option in my Firefox 84 was Boolean 0. And that does give you page changing backspace behavior that we've always had. And I experimented with it. I set it to 1 and then restarted Firefox, assuming that I had to. I didn't actually check that. And that, sure enough, causes backspace to be ignored when you're not entering text. And so this, so the point is, this is already in there, and it's, you know, in about colon config, one of Firefox's bazillion settings. So this suggests that with release 86, they're going to simply flip that existing 0 to a 1 in order to flip the default behavior of Firefox. And so anybody who will miss that can easily go in and turn it back to 0 as it is today. A couple notes about ransomware. Security researchers, following the flow of Bitcoin transactions from the victims of Ryuk's ransomware into the bad guy's pockets, estimate that the Ryuk operation has netted at least, that is, they've been able to like track at least $150 million. They discovered that Ryuk's operators primarily used two legitimate cryptocurrency exchanges to cash out the Bitcoin from paying victims, you know, into fiat money, regular money. Two threat intelligence companies, Advanced Intelligence and HYAS, tracked 61 Bitcoin wallets attributed to the Ryuk malware enterprise. They discovered that the cryptocurrency moves from an intermediary to the it's HUOBI, Huobi maybe, and Binance exchanges. When Ryuk victims pay the ransom, the money first passes through a broker who passes it to the malware operators. The money then goes through a laundering service before getting to legitimate cryptocurrency exchanges or being used to pay for criminal services on underground markets. The researchers explained that in addition to the large and well-established Huobi and Binance exchanges, there are significant flows of cryptocurrency to a collection of addresses that are too small to be an established exchange and probably represent a crime service that exchanges the cryptocurrency for local currency or another digital currency. One of the largest transactions involving a Ryuk wallet found during this investigation was more than $5 million in a single transaction, or 365 Bitcoin at the time. But that payout was not the largest ransom ever paid. In an earlier report, Advanced Intelligence said that the largest payment confirmed to these attackers was 2,200 Bitcoin, which converted to $34 million at the time.
Holy cow.
$34 million, Leo.
Wow.
You could buy yourself a whole new, like, everything. Network and servers. I mean, wouldn't you love to know what company thought, well, yeah, that we should pay that.
Good Lord. Yeah. Wow.
Wow. The average ransom value received by Ryuk is 48 Bitcoins. So they're, you know, they're making money.
That's a lot, yeah.
Yeah, even that. Another highly profitable ransomware gang we've talked about often is Reval, or Sodino Kibi, who announced through a public-facing representative that they made $100 million in 1 year from extorting their victims. They said that their goal was to make $2 billion. As we know, their affiliate-based program does potentially allow them to grow and expand their rate of incursion. A few months ago, we noted that they had ended their, you know, we have all the people we need for now status and are again seeking to recruit new affiliates into the fold. So, you know, they're in a growth phase at the moment. Okay, now, yesterday, during the 2021 CES, right, the Consumer Electronics Show, with great fanfare, Intel announced that their 11th generation Core V Pro CPUs will have support for their boot protecting hardware shield and something known as threat detection technology, TDT. This threat detection technology, they claim, will be able to, quote, detect ransomware attacks at the hardware silicon level, many layers below antivirus software, unquote. Now, okay, naturally, that was of interest to me. So I spent some time digging a bit deeper into these claims. And frankly, it's nonsense. It appears to be pure marketing hype. The press release said Intel TDT uses a combination of CPU telemetry and ML, of course that's now one of the buzzwords, right, machine learning, heuristics, to detect attack behavior. It detects ransomware and other threats that leave a footprint on Intel CPU Performance Monitoring Unit, the PMU. They said the Intel PMU sits beneath, I'll just call it the PU, anyway, sits beneath applications, the OS, and virtualization layers on the system, and delivers a more accurate representation of active threats. And I'm shaking my head while I'm reading this, system-wide. They said, as threats are detected in real time, Intel TDT sends a high-fidelity signal that can trigger remediation workflows in the security vendor's code. Okay, what we have there is an example of some creative writing.
Yeah, no kidding.
The biggest malware threat faced by the enterprise we know today is ransomware. And nothing has been able to slow it down so far. But wait, Intel has a new chip, and it has a hardware ransomware detector built in.
Wow.
It can finally put an end to this scourge.
Woo-hoo.
So quickly cancel your short position on Intel stock.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And instead buy as much as you can, kids. Intel's future is once again bright. Except, of course, none of that is true. The marketing guys apparently met with the engineering guys. And they asked, okay, so the Gen 11 vPro processors have this, you call it a PMU? What's it good for? How can we sell that? And the engineering guys scratched their heads a bit and said, in theory, since the PMU is seeing everything that's going on at the processor core level, it's impossible to hide anything from it. Really, truly impossible. So that means that if something malicious was going on anywhere in the system, even if it was tucked away inside a virtual machine, it would have to affect the PMU. Whereupon the marketing guys interrupted and said, hold on, wait a minute. Does that mean that the PMU could detect ransomware?
Ooh.
And the engineer said, well, and the marketing guy said, perfect. Now we can sell the crap out of this thing. To give you a feel for the flavor of this nonsense, Stephanie Halford, Intel's Client Computing Group Vice President and General Manager of Business Client Platforms, was quoted to say, that doesn't fit on her business card, by the way, it has had to wrap around the back, quote, ransomware was a top security threat in 2020. Software alone is not enough to protect against ongoing threats. Our new 11th Gen Core V Pro mobile platform provides the industry's first silicon-enabled threat detection capability. Wow, that sounds great. Delivering the much needed hardware-based protection against these types of attacks, together with Cyber Reason's multi-layered protection, businesses will have full stack visibility, because again, that's another buzzword. You got to have full stack in there somewhere. From CPU telemetry to help prevent ransomware from evading traditional signature-based defenses. And then the press release noted that although Cyber Reason will be the first to support detecting ransomware using hardware indicators, other security vendors will most likely tap into it in the future. Okay, so I wanted to provide some preemptive context for this announcement in case any of our listeners encounter the news of an Intel breakthrough in ransomware prevention. It didn't happen. You know, I will double dip guarantee you that a system that's fully armed with this nonsense is every bit as vulnerable as the systems we have today. Could it possibly be of some value? Sure. But only if you knew precisely what to look for in advance, and only if regular system activity didn't constantly throw up false positives. At first blush, it sounds amazing that by being down so low in the silicon, there's no way for the actions of ransomware to avoid detection. That would be true. But the trouble with being so low down in the silicon is that all context is lost. Down there, you have no idea what's going on up above. You see registers being loaded and unloaded. Math is happening. Jumps are being taken or not. Memory is being read and written. Subroutine calls are being made and returned from, and transitions are being made among various OS privilege rings. But it's all completely anonymous. There's absolutely no context. Everything, you know, everyone is reading and writing registers, doing math, retrieving and storing to memory, making OS calls. So there's no way to know what any of that actually means down there. Maybe a malware prevention system operating up at the application layer could augment everything it already knows with the information that will someday be available from an Intel 11th generation vPro processor, which contains the optional extra cost PMU. Maybe. But even getting to maybe seems uncertain to me. So, yeah.
So the PMU just really is seeing microcode or assembly language
level
stuff.
Yeah, it's just seeing instructions.
And I guess if there were a typical signature for ransomware, you know, an instruction only ransomware used or something like that, you might say, well, you know, that's suspicious. But right. I can't imagine.
Unfortunately,
it looks that different.
There ain't no such thing.
Yeah.
One of the problems is ransomware looks like just another application.
Yeah.
You know, it's running.
It's encryption.
And it's reading and writing things and like doing stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, Leo, we now have the strange case of the male chastity cage.
About time. I can think of some people who should wear this.
On the lighter side, I suppose, unless you're unfortunate enough to be wearing one. Remember those bizarre IoT chastity devices for men that we briefly covered some time ago? It's the Cellmate, Cellmate.
Uh-huh.
I guess as in cell phone. It's the Cellmate chastity cage.
What?
A bargain at $169. Mm-hmm. That's for the small model.
Well, I need a large. I'm sorry. I can't.
As I've taken to saying more recently, what could possibly go wrong? Although perhaps what is wrong with this picture would be more fitting in this instance. So it should come as no surprise to anyone that the software behind these devices, would that be firmware? Anyway, behind these devices,
it's all hardware,
was,
baby.
Was not the hardware, but hopefully not while it's still while you're wearing this thing.
Wow,
was not of the highest grade. Mm-mm. Last October, researchers at Pen Test Partners published details about a serious vulnerability that allowed a remote attacker to take control of any cellmate device. They began their disclosure with the observation, in this research, it helps to have an open mind and to not be judgmental.
I'd rather have an open chastity.
Yeah. In an effort to keep, I guess, it a bit tongue-in-cheek, they obtained a subdomain of the .gs, top-level domain, which allowed them to post their serious and authentic security research at the easily remembered domain Internet of Dongs.
Oh, jeez. Oh, God, I'm so sorry.
In their TLDR, they summarized the situation in a series of bullet points. Smart Bluetooth male chastity lock designed for user to give remote control to a trusted third party using mobile app API. Multiple API flaws meant anyone could remotely lock all devices
oh, no.
and prevent users from releasing themselves.
Oh, no.
Removal then requires an angle grinder or similar used in close proximity to delicate and sensitive areas. Precise user location data is also leaked by the API, including personal information and private chats. You know, get me out of this thing. Vendor initially responsive, then missed three remediation deadlines they set themselves over a six-month period, finally refusing to interact any further, even though majority of issues were resolved in migration to version 2 API, yet API version 1 inexcusably remained available. And I should say remains current tense, present tense available. The researchers wrote, "We are not in the business of kink shaming. People should be able to use these devices safely and securely without the risk of sensitive personal data being leaked. The security of the teledildonics field is interesting in its own right."
Oh, yes.
It's worth noting that sales of smart adult toys has risen significantly during the recent lockdown. And
well,
I suppose that this
sense.
Brings
yes.
new. I suppose this brings new meaning to the term lockdown, Leo.
And by the way, on a related note, I want to announce a new sponsor for the show, Manscaped, which is software to help you get out of your chastity belt if you inadvertently get locked in. Manscaped.com. Okay, go ahead. That was ad number two.
Okay, so in describing the risk to users, they wrote, "We discovered that remote attackers could prevent the Bluetooth lock from being opened, permanently locking the user in the device. There is no physical unlock. The tube is locked onto a ring worn around the base of the genitals, making things inaccessible. An angle grinder or other suitable heavy tool would be required to cut the wearer free. The user's location, their plain text password, and other personal data was also leaked without need for authentication by the API. They said, "We had particular problems during the disclosure process, as we would usually ask the vendor to take down a leaky API whilst remediation was being implemented. However, anyone currently using the device when the API was taken down would also be permanently locked in. as you will see in the disclosure timeline at the bottom of this post. Some issues were remediated, but others were not. And the vendor simply stopped replying to us, to journalists, and to retailers. Given the trivial nature of finding some of these issues, and that the company is working on another device which poses even greater potential physical harm, and then they said in parens, an internal chastity device, we felt compelled to publish these findings at this point. So, somewhat predictably, following the disclosure, an attacker started targeting Cellmate mobile app users. Thus, this is in the ransomware section of the podcast because they were being asked to pay 0.02 Bitcoin, around $270 at the time of the attacks, in order to have their device released. All of these things have been locked, and users are now having to pay to be released. So, thus, we witness the rare birth of a new class of ransomware.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And Leo, I think this is a good point.
Good place.
To take our second break, and I'm going to get a sip of water.
Barracuda will be so happy to follow that story. We're talking security with Steve Gibson. When you talk security, I know the name Barracuda resonates. It's probably one of the best-known providers of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions to protect everything. Email, networks, data, applications. Let's talk about email and Barracuda's total email protection for your Microsoft 365 account. Email is the number one way. 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email. Spear phishing, ransomware, account takeover, conversation hijacking. It's just the easiest way to get to your employees. Made even easier these days by the fact that your employees probably aren't even at the office anymore. They're working from home on their own network of dubious security, on machines with perhaps not the best security. Just think about all those emails, each one of them potentially destroying your company, costing you money and customers and your reputation. Thousands of emails coming in every day. You need some sort of protection. You need Barracuda Total Email Protection. It includes all-in-one email security, plus backup, plus archiving, which is something actually really good in a lot of businesses. That backup and archiving is not only legally required, it's the best way to survive if you do get, have data loss. You get AI-based protection from spear phishing, from account takeover, from business email compromise. You need... something that actually is smart enough to respond to changing attack modalities. Bad guys are not sitting still. They're trying different stuff all the time. So your threat protection needs to be smart enough to adapt, to adjust, to take care of those problems. You also get an automated incident response that gives you options to quickly and efficiently address attacks. That's important. We know the faster you can remediate, the less damage that's going to happen. Maybe this is the most important. You get security awareness training to educate your workforce so your employees can be the first line of defense against attack. Right now, there are new attacks all the time. In fact, there's been a big spike in coronavirus-related emails. As you might imagine, they impersonate the World Health Organization. I mean, they use domain spoofing, so they really look like the WHO or the CDC. They offer valuable information. Imagine your employee getting an email, let's say from you, from the boss, saying we've arranged for vaccinations for all our team. Open the PDF to get the schedule and locations. And who's not going to click on that? Well, your employees won't if they've get this training. Truth is, if you've got Barracuda Total Email Protection, they won't even get the email in the first place, so they won't have a chance to click on that. You got to ensure the safety and security of your business, and you should do it with the best-known name in this, Barracuda. Now, this may be a little scary. This may not be something you want to do, but you got to do. They are offering a free, completely secure email threat scan of your Office 365 account. And there's no risk, no cost to you. I know there are people going, I don't want to know, but you got to know. You got to know. Go to you may not like what you hear, but at least you'll know, right? Barracuda.com/security now. Barracuda. Barracuda.com/security now. Barracuda, your journey secured. We love Barracuda. They do great stuff. We use them. You should too. Barracuda.com/security now. All right, back to you, Steve.
So yesterday's post by Kaspersky Labs was titled Sunburst Backdoor Code Overlaps with Kazuar. It's Kazuar, a known Russian-sourced malware. And in their post, following their de rigueur what is Sunburst reminder, as if anyone reading a Kaspersky posting doesn't already know, they introduce us to what they have found. They wrote, in a previous blog, we dissected the method used by Sunburst to communicate with its command and control, you know, C2 server, and the protocol by which victims are upgraded for further exploitation. Similarly, many other security companies published their own analysis of the Sunburst backdoor, various operational details, and how to defend against this attack. Yet, besides some media articles, no solid technical papers have been published that could potentially link it to previously known activity. They said, while looking at the Sunburst backdoor, we discovered several features that overlap with a previously identified backdoor known as Kazuar. Kazuar is a .NET backdoor first reported by Palo Alto Networks in 2017. Palo Alto tentatively linked Kazuar to the Turla APT group, although no solid attribution link has been made public. Our own observations indeed confirm that Kazuar was used together with other Turla tools during multiple breaches in past years. A number of unusual shared features between Sunburst and Kazuar include the victim UID generation algorithm, the sleeping algorithm, and the extensive use of the FNV-1A hash. Okay, so on the podcast, we've never had occasion to talk about the FNV1 hash because it's not cryptographically secure. FNV are the initials of the hash's inventors, Fowler, Knoll, and Vo. What the hash can boast of is its very small implementation size and its speed and its fully tunable output length. The hash operates in a very simple loop. The current hash is multiplied by an FNV prime value. Then a byte of input is XORed into the result. That's repeated until all of the input is be consumed. And I looked at the actual code implementation in Kaspersky's posting, and it's like, you know, 5 instructions. So it's going to be screamingly fast, and it provides a way for them to create a very fast, lightweight hash. Anyway, the Kaspersky report goes on to into great detail, showing reverse-engineered code from Sunburst and Kazuar, and specifically addresses the problem and challenge of false flag deception where attribution is deliberately misdirected. And finally, after a long posting, they conclude saying, these code overlaps between Kazuar and Sunburst are interesting and represent the first potential identified link to a previously known malware family. Although the usage of the sleeping algorithm may be too wide, the custom implementation of the FNV1A hashes and the reuse of the MD5 plus XOR algorithm in Sunburst are definitely important clues. We should also point out that although similar, the UID calculation subroutine and the FNV1A hash usage as well as the sleep loop, are still not 100% identical. They said possible explanations for these similarities include sunburst was developed by the same group as casuar, or the sunburst developers adopted some ideas or code from casuar without having a direct connection, like, you know, they use casuar as an inspiration point. Or both groups, Dark Halo, UNC 2452, and the group using casuar, obtained their malware from the same original source. Or some of the casuar developers moved to another team, taking knowledge and tools with them. And finally, or the sunburst developers introduced these subtle links as a form of false flag in order to shift blame to another group. So, still, at the moment, now weeks downstream of this, and with no little amount of attention and focus being brought to bear, we do not know which one of these options is true. While casuar and sunburst may be related, the nature of this relation is still not clear. Through further analysis, it's possible that evidence confirming one or several of these points may arise. At the same time, it's also possible that the sunburst developers were really good at their operational security and didn't make any mistakes, with this link being thereby an elaborate false flag. In any case, this overlap doesn't change much for the defenders. Supply chain attacks, as we know, are some of the most sophisticated types of attacks these days, and they've been successfully used in the past by APT groups. The Kaspersky guys say, they note, to limit exposure to supply chain attacks, they said, we recommend the following. Isolate network management software in separate VLANs, monitor them separately from the user networks. Limit outgoing internet connections from servers or appliances that are running third-party software. Implement regular memory dumping and analysis, checking for malicious code running in a decrypted state using a code similarity solution. That's actually, that third one is very cool. It's one of the ways that Kaspersky's proprietary tools operate, is that, you know, we know that polymorphic encryption is used to prevent signature analysis by AV tools. You know, each instance of the malware is encrypted under a different key so that it looks like completely different random gibberish. And even the decryption algorithm that must be somewhere in the decrypted blob, that's dynamically generated so that it never looks the same twice. But what's common among all of those is once it's decrypted and running in RAM, it's the same item every single time. It is highly repetitive, but, you know, it's only once it's in memory that you're going to see that. So anyway, as we know, Kaspersky is a Russia-based security firm. They've taken a lot of heat about that over the years. We've touched on that from time to time. Does that color their conclusions? We don't know. Attribution is, as we know, in cyberspace is incredibly difficult, and it remains so. As for the U.S. government, last Tuesday, our intelligence and law enforcement agencies here in the U.S., including the FBI, CISA, the ODNI, and the NSA, jointly published a statement. They said, speaking of this massive attack, this work indicates that an advanced persistent threat actor, likely Russian in origin, is responsible for most or all of the recently discovered ongoing cyber compromises of both government and non-governmental networks. So, okay, the press jumped on this as, you know, the U.S. government formally accuses Russia. And it's like, okay, wait, they said likely. And, you know, frankly, likely Russian certainly falls far short of being definitive. And at this point, it seems that the inherent difficulty of attribution in cyberspace is what rules the day. And I'm frankly impressed that they're not claiming proof that they don't have. And the problem is, it's just difficult to prove. As I heard you recently, I think I was on some other podcast, Leo, talking about, you know, the problem of attribution in cyber. Right. It's just, you know, it's so possible to set up a false flag, to deliberately bounce IP traffic through someone else, or to use someone else's code, which anybody can get, you know, by reverse engineering, in order to set up something that looks like it's the work of those people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you just don't know.
Turla is another Russian group, though, thought to be Russian. So if Kaspersky wanted to, you know, defer responsibility
elsewhere.
I think they would choose something that's not Russian. So, I do think, though, that it's completely credible. These guys are so good that they copied or intentionally put those false flags in there. Or maybe they had the source code for Turla and just said, well, that works well, we'll just borrow that.
Well, yeah, and you'd have to think also that, as you say, being as good as they are, they would recognize that the chance of the connection being made, mm-hmm. or maybe they just don't care.
Or
you know,
they don't
it's
care.
Like, you know, we're going to stay hidden as long as we can. Once we're no longer hidden, well, then it doesn't matter. And, you know, also, unfortunately, what are you going to do about it?
That's really the big point. So, what are you going to do? What are you going to do?
In SolarWinds news, we also talked about the trouble that the SolarWinds Corporation would likely be facing in the future. Predictably, a class action lawsuit has been filed by shareholders of SolarWinds beleaguered stock. The named defendants in the suit are SolarWinds president, Kevin Thompson, and chief financial officer, J. Barton Kalsu. The suit alleges that the executives violated federal securities laws under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. And embedded in the suit was a bit of information that raised my eyebrows. Among the many other grievances enumerated by the plaintiffs was the fact that the SolarWinds update server used the password SolarWinds123. So,
password 123, I think. Wasn't it password?
SolarWinds 123.
Wow.
So again, wouldn't be a big stretch. You know, it's not the first thing you would guess, but wow, it's certainly not uppercase Z, you know, backtick, lowercase Q, and so forth.
It's more on the Cheeto side.
SolarWinds 1-2. It's better than a Cheeto. Yeah. In fact, Leo, that's got to be one of our new. We have TNO, trust no one. And now we have better than a Cheeto.
Better than a Cheeto.
Or maybe beats a Cheeto. Yeah. Okay. So the Krebs Stamos Group, in a bid to manage the security side of the mess created by the SolarWinds hack, SolarWinds has hired a freshly founded consultancy known as the Krebs Stamos Group.
And I like the name.
I do.
It's Chris Krebs, which Krebs is it? Not Brian. It's Chris Krebs. Yes. Yeah, former.
And what's cool is the URL. Dot group is a TLD, so they are KS dot group.
Oh, that's a good URL. Yeah.
Krebs Stamos Group. So the front page banner of that page, actually it's not the front page, it's the only page of their new website, declares, Krebs Stamos Group helps organizations turn their greatest cybersecurity challenges into triumphs. And in the case of SolarWinds, well, good luck with that.
Can they turn my Bitcoin into dollars? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. And yes, both of those names should be familiar to our listeners. Krebs is not Brian Krebs. It's Chris Krebs, the original and now previous head of the United States CISA, who, while still head of CISA, had the unwelcome temerity to publicly state that the recent U.S. presidential election was the most secure ever, whereupon Chris became the previous head of CISA. And Stamos is, of course, Alex Stamos, Facebook's former CISO and founder of the Stanford Internet Observatory. As we know, shortly following the multiple Zoom security debacles in early 2020, Alex has been helping Zoom manage their new security challenges. Presumably now this will fall under the Krebs Stamos Group umbrella. And it's going to be interesting to see where this duo pops up in the future. As the industry's highest profile security disaster response group, I have the feeling that we're going to be seeing more of them. Maybe speaking of which, maybe Zeixel. Is that how you pronounce it? Zeixel?
I always say Zeixel. I don't know if that's accurate or not.
Zeixel. Yeah, that's.
Used to have a Zeixel modem way back when. It was a 56K bar.
Yeah, it was originally really good hardware.
They were the best modems. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So last Tuesday, right while we were talking about the new threat facing the more than 100,000 Zeixel VPN and other security endpoint customers, you know, they've got a whole family of security endpoints. Gray Noise Intelligence was observing that the previously unknown ZYFWP account name had been added to SSH scanners and was now being actively probed across the internet.
Of course. Of course.
Uh-huh. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Johannes Ulrich of the SANS Internet Storm Center last week said, likely due to the holidays and maybe because the discoverer of the backdoor account did not initially publish the matching password, widespread exploitation via SSH had not started until now. But we are seeing attempts to access our SSH honeypots via these default credentials. Ulrich said the scan started last Monday afternoon, stemming from one IP, 185.153.196.230, and more scans from other IPs, 5.8.16.167, 47.155.250.86, joined throughout this week, that is, past week. He said the initial IPs scanning for this are all geolocated back to Russia. But other than that, they are not specifically significant. Some of these IPs have been involved in similar internet-wide scans for vulnerabilities before, so they are likely part of some criminal infrastructure. Of course, this backdoor account is now widely public. And so it permits an incredibly serious risk, because anyone on the internet can now use it to create new VPN accounts to give themselves access to internal networks or to port forward internal services to make them remotely accessible and exploitable. It is looking like it's going to become a horrific disaster. I have a hunch we will be, you know, we'll either see a big jump in ransomware attacks or just, you know, news of people becoming victims to this. This, I don't know, 100,000 of these, and they're, you know, they're in back rooms, they're in closets, they're, and they're not, you know, and then Zeixel says, oh, be sure to update. Hello, who? Wow. Meanwhile, up until now, WhatsApp's privacy policy opened with the claim that, quote, respect for your privacy is coded into our DNA. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
They said, since we started WhatsApp, we have aspired to build our services with a set of strong privacy principles in mind. Well, that was then. I think it was 2016. The news that the respect for the privacy of WhatsApp's user metadata is being lost has triggered a mass exodus from Facebook's in-house communications platform over to Signal, where no user metadata is ever collected. Back in 2016, WhatsApp gave its users a one-time ability to opt out of having account data turned over to Facebook. But now, their updated privacy policy taking effect next month on February 8th changes that. 1 month from now, users will no longer have that choice. Some of the data that WhatsApp collects and will be sharing includes users' phone numbers, other people's phone numbers stored in address books, profile names, profile photos, location information, transactions and payment data, device and connection information, status messages, including when a user was last online, and diagnostic data collected from app logs. They may not be seeing what you're saying, but they have and will shortly be using every other last scrap of available metadata. Under the new terms, Facebook reserves the right to share collected data across its family of companies. And in some cases, such as when someone uses WhatsApp to interact with third-party businesses, Facebook may also share information with those outside entities. This privacy agreement update is a 180 compared with last year's privacy policy, whose enforcement began last July. It states that users are able to choose not to have their WhatsApp account info shared with Facebook to improve the company's ads and products. But under the changes to the policy, users will now be forced to accept sharing their data with Facebook to continue using their account, or as an alternative, delete their account. WhatsApp notification reads, quote, "By tapping agree, all caps, you accept the new terms and privacy policy, which take effect on February 8th, 2021. After this date, you'll need to accept these updates to continue using WhatsApp." So given the supreme lack of subtlety shown, it really does feel like a bit of a bait and switch. On the other hand, I mentioned that Signal was experiencing a mass influx of ex-WhatsApp users. It turns out that Signal's infrastructure was for a while a bit unprepared and overwhelmed by this rush. Bleeping Computer reported last Friday that Signal had now recovered from sign-up delays, which had previously been affecting its user verification process. When setting up Signal for the first time, users must verify their mobile number using verification codes sent by Signal. And Leo, you've noted that this is sort of an unfortunate loop that Signal is requiring. There are some other good, end-to-end encryption solutions that don't require that. Anyway, the surge in new users switching to Signal overwhelmed the verification service, causing significant delays across various mobile providers. You know, of course, that's the sort of problem you'd like to have. Signal tweeted on the 7th, when they were finally beginning to recover, that was last Thursday, "Everyone should be able to register without delay again, thanks to all of the carriers who flipped the right switches so that people can keep switching." I don't know what that means. Maybe they got shut down due to a tweet storm, or an attempt to do too many SMS messages in a short period of time. On the 8th, they said, Signal tweeted, "New users in Europe should be able to register without delay again. We will continue to work with carriers to keep delivering a record high number of Signal verification codes. The Signal service itself is operating normally. Thanks for your patience." Later the same day, on January 8th, some new users are reporting that Signal is slow to display their Signal contacts. "We're adding more capacity to keep up with all the new people searching for their friends on Signal. Hang tight." The next day on the 9th, they tweeted, not to sound like a broken record about broken records, but we're aware of the registration delays while creating a new account. Carriers are making adjustments on their side to keep delivering verification codes as quickly as possible. Leo, this must have been a mass exodus. Later on the 9th, even though we're still breaking records, verification codes are back in the groove. Delivery delays have been eliminated across multiple cellular providers, so things should be more ASAP when you join the app. And finally, on the 10th, which was Sunday, 2 days ago, they tweeted, we continue to shatter traffic records and add capacity as more and more people come to terms with how much they dislike Facebook's new terms. If you weren't able to create a new group recently, please try again. New servers are ready to serve you. So, wow.
It's great. I'm really happy to hear that. I hope people make the shift. It'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I guess, you know, it certainly Facebook has the right to whatever terms and conditions they want. I'm sure there are lots of users that will still use Facebook because it's, I mean, still use WhatsApp because it's part of the Facebook family of properties. And, you know, getting more relevant ads is what they want. So, like, okay. But lots of users are clearly a little annoyed by the – and notice that, you know, again, this is not – anyone's conversation that is being decrypted. This is just all the metadata. So it does also feel like people are beginning to understand more about the subtleties of the difference between your conversation versus metadata.
Yeah.
So
thanks to Apple,
cool,
really exposing that. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
And Apple has been moving in the other direction, as they know. They're getting better about requiring apps to be very clear about exactly what they're going to be doing with their users' data.
Mm-hmm.
So I did want to just take a moment to mention The Expanse on Amazon Prime. We first talked about The Expanse many years ago when it was initially, for the first 3 years, it was a sci-fi property. And when it had been announced, I remember Mark Thompson telling me that it was coming and he was excited. He had read.
You loved the novels, I know.
Yes, yeah. He had read them. I immediately read them because, as we know, the books are always better. Although, boy, I've just started rewatching it. I know that you had. We talked about this last week or the week before. Lori had never seen it. I was a little worried that it might be a little too, you know, out in the weeds for her, but, you know, she's tolerating it at least. and I just have to say, I had forgotten how good it was. I mean, it is really good.
Yeah.
I mean, you need to really pay attention. There is some problem, like, with articulation where it's like, what did she just say?
Right.
But, you know, it doesn't, that kind of stuff really doesn't matter. But, you know, and they're speaking in a language that they made up in some, like, little snippets here and there, which are just, you know, to provide some color. And again, not important to the plot. But for what it's worth, so what happened was it was incredibly popular on sci-fi. And they chose to not continue the series, not because it wasn't super popular and the production values weren't like amazingly high, especially for the sci-fi channel, but over some contractual problems with distribution. Things got – I don't know what the details were, but, you know, they just said, okay, fine. We're, if that's the way you're going to be somebody, then we're not going to do it again. A crowd-funded airplane – was financed to fly circles around Amazon headquarters, trying to get Bezos to pick it up. And Jeff did. And what I found interesting was the ratings
that. Why it got picked up. Wow.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
And the ratings have only gone up since then. It is now, the last few seasons are 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. And it's always in the high nines on IMDb. So anyway, for what it's worth, you know, again, there is a lot of like, well, in fact, you know, at one point, Lori said, I hope this is not going to be constant shooting. And and it's anything but. I mean, it's my concern is that it was a little too much, you know, internecine political right. machinations right. between Earth and Mars and those out in the belt, the belters. But I just think it's wonderful. So just a heads up to our listeners that – and it's on Amazon Prime. So, you know,
yeah, you're a Prime user. Yeah, yeah,
probably get it for free. And boy, and five seasons now. So and I think maybe I saw the first three before, so I'm having no problem rewatching them. As I said, I forgot how really high quality it was. And before long, I'll be going past where I read in the novels out into new territory. Okay, so the title of the podcast is Out with the Old, inspired by my previous week of digging around inside SpinRite. I've frankly been amazed as I've been encountering and remembering how much functionality I managed to cram into this system over time. And thinking, it made me think back. There were so many kludges, and my favorite word again, perpetrated upon the industry as our early PCs kept outgrowing their modest beginnings. Of course, you know, Gates was famously quoted saying back, you know, the previous CPM machines were absolutely limited to 64K of RAM. And Bill was quoted of saying when the IBM PC came out with 640K, woo, 10 times as much, you know, oh, we'll never need more than that. Anyway, one of the many problems was that mass storage size grew beyond anyone's wildest expectations. And as we know, in the 40 years since, the PC's August 12th, 1981. So, Leo, this August 12th, the PC will be 40 years old. And we're 40 years older, my friend. But this pace of mass storage growth has never let up. So to remain useful, SpinRite had to deal with every weird thing a system might do. For example, when the total sector count limit was reached, device drivers were created to deliberately misrepresent the size of sectors on the system's media. If you couldn't have more sectors, at least the sectors you could have could be made larger. Physical sectors transferred from devices, the actual physical devices, have always been 512 bytes. But an intermediate device driver would tell DOS that the mass storage device was using, for example, 4,096 byte sectors. So that's what DOS would see. And that's the way it would format the drive. All file system data structures would then occur in what was actually 8 physical sector multiples rather than the truth of 1 physical sector. And this was fine for DOS since it really didn't care how big sectors were. It believed what it was told. But of course, SpinRite was accessing the drive directly and beneath any device driver. So it needed to juggle this 8-to-1, and it wasn't always 8-to-1, it could be any multiple, of logical versus physical sector reality. And that juggling had to happen for everything SpinRite did. And remember that the very popular DOS at the time, version 3.3, DOS 3.3 was like the one we had for a long time at the beginning. It had a, get this, a 32 megabyte limit, 32 megabyte.
Per file.
No. DOS 3.3's entire partition, the C partition.
It'll be 32 reason, megs?
Yes, 32 megs. It was actually 33,400,000 554,432 bytes. Where did that come from? It came from DOS's logical sector number, which back then was 16 bits.
Right.
DOS had a 16-bit sector number.
And to of be course, fair, most bits, people didn't have hard drives that big, so it was okay.
Right. You could get you could choose. Do you want 5 megabytes or 10 megabytes?
I remember when I got a 20 megabyte drive, I was so excited.
Oh, Leo.
That was that new MFM technology. So 32 megabytes probably at the time seemed fine.
The 20 megabyte was the Seagate ST225 drive.
That's right, boy.
So 16 bits gives us 65,536, right? 64K in binary sectors. You multiply 65536 sectors by 512 bytes per sector, and you get 33.55 and some megabytes. That was the largest possible partition that DOS 3.3 could handle. And it's interesting, I was thinking about all this while we're talking about PC history, when I encountered that 33.55 megabyte limit, I was reminded of something I wrote long ago. One of the ideas I had when I was writing the InfoWorld Tech Talk column was to design what I called Steve's dream machine, where every component was carefully selected for cost effectiveness and value. Like, you know, this is the motherboard you want and exactly why. You know, this is the RAM you want and exactly why, and so on. Well, there was a MiniScribe 3650 drive that was 42 megabytes under its rated MFM encoding, but it was high quality enough to handle RLL's 50% storage increase, bringing it up to 64 megabytes when formatted with an RLL controller, which was the Adaptec 2372. That was my choice of the best controller. And it turned out that the drive advertised fewer cylinders than were required to deliver a second partition, because if you have a 42 megabyte drive, but you hook it to an RLL controller, now it's at 64 megabytes. But DOS 3.3's maximum partition size is 32 binary megabytes. So you got to have two partitions, because you can't just have one. The drive's now too big for the maximum DOS partition. So it turned out that the drive advertised fewer cylinders than were required to deliver a second partition of the maximum possible size under DOS 3.3. Although they weren't advertised, the required additional cylinders were physically there, and I discovered that they worked. So one of the coolest hacks I used for and promoted for Steve's Dream Machine was to format the drive further toward its spindle to obtain additional storage. Then FDisk could create a C and a D that each contained the absolute maximum size of a DOS partition, that 33 plus million sectors. And, you know, it was a gimmick, but it was fun. And the concept was quite popular back then. And I thought, I wonder if this is still online, because I know that a lot of InfoWorld ended up getting put online. I actually found, if anyone is interested, it is sort of a blast from the past.
Yeah.
I found the text of that original InfoWorld column online. It was titled, "A Hard Disk Drive for Steve's Dream Machine." And I excerpted the relevant partition, the relevant portion. I said, "The MiniScribe 3650 is not quite officially RLL certified, though I hear rumors that it's about to be, simply because it works so well. I've tested many of them myself, and the bright boys at Northgate Computer Systems, who turned me onto this drive in the first place, are shipping thousands with RLL controllers in their 286 AT compatibles. They've had no problems. I'm quite comfortable with the 3650 and RLL encoding." Finally, the 3650 is rated as having 809 cylinders, although it actually has 852. I've been low-level formatting mine out to 842 cylinders. Then, under DOS 3.3 with RLL encoding, you get two maximum size 33.4 megabyte DOS partitions, exclamation point. They couldn't be any bigger, exclamation point. 67 fast megabytes in an inexpensive half-height drive is hard to beat.
Stand back. Wow. That's great.
So
somebody typed by the way. That's hand typed from from your column.
Hand transcribed from the column.
That's hysterical.
So anyway, as I was saying, DOS back then was designed to manage a maximum of 64K sectors. But if you needed more storage, you could add a device driver to lie about the size of each of those sectors to obtain many times the storage. And I wrote this as I was this just came to mind as I was writing this. I think there was a company called OnTrack that bundled its driver that bundled its driver with many hard drives at the time.
Yeah, I remember.
Is a device driver that did that with many hard drives. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you were a Seagate or a Western Digital or a Miniscribe or anybody who was making larger hard drives, yet DOS was stuck at 32 meg, then you needed some way of letting the user get to all of their hard drive storage. So I'm sure OnTrack made a bundle because there was one of those little a 5 1/4 floppy with every hard drive you bought, which installed that device driver on the fly.
Yep.
And it did this lie. It told DOS that its sectors were much larger, so that its 64K sectors would now span a much larger drive. Anyway, SpinRite, because of its unique position in this, it had to have code to straddle that lie. It had to operate with DOS's view of logical sectors while at the same time working with the actual underlying true 512-byte physical sectors. So, you know, the history of our early PCs is littered, and it really has become litter, with storage size limitations because no one ever expected what happened. The original hard drives were limited to 10 24 cylinders, 16 heads, and 63 sectors. So that's 10 bits for cylinder, only 4 bits for head, and 6 bits for the sector. The sector count was 63 because for some reason, no one knows, there never was a sector 0. Sectors were always numbered from 1. But that set of size limitations imposed a larger 504 megabyte upper limit on hard disk size. If you worked around that limitation, or in order to work around that limitation, early BIOSes used a byte for the head number. So now you could have 255 heads, or 256 actually, 0 to 255. That led to all of those wacky cylinder head sector, remember the CHS translation schemes, where
what a nightmare was.
Yes.
I can only imagine coding for it. I mean, bad enough we had to use it.
Exactly. I had to penetrate that translation lie. But even so, the limit then was 7.84 gig. And even the early ATA spec, which expanded the cylinder count out to 64K cylinders, you know, 65536, a full 16-bit cylinder number, finally, not just 10 bits, it still had only 4 bits in its registers for 16 heads. So more translation needed. You translate the heads up and the cylinders down. But it did allow for 255 sectors. So then you could now get to 127.8 gig using BIOS head translation with an ATA drive. So it's just been like one after another short-sighted design which we kludged ourselves around. Oh, and Leo, then came along the monkey wrench of on-the-fly partition compression. Oh my God.
Was that now, Stacker and stuff like that?
Yes, exactly. Oh, Stacker from Stack Corporation. Oh. And double
this
drive.
This is all coming.
Double disc.
Double disc, was that it? Double?
Double something or other. Double trouble.
Yeah.
Now, because a compressing device driver had been added between DOS and the underlying mass storage, what DOS was seeing was an entirely fictitious drive partition with an amount of free space that was fluctuating based upon the dynamic compression ratio of all the data that had been stored so far. Again, SpinWrite needed to bracket any on-the-fly compression driver, sometimes seeing the drive from DOS's bizarre and dynamically changing perspective, and relating that to what was still happening down at the drive's actual true 512 bytes per sector reality. It was all a horrific mess. But SpinWrite just had to work in any and all situations. It needed to, and it did, figure all of that out and just deal with it so that users could simply run it no matter what their system was doing, and it would just work. And one other piece of SpinWrite engineering that I recently encountered in the last week and had completely forgotten about was that SpinWrite might be writing to its a file into its own detailed technical log, recording everything it found and did back onto the same drive it was working on. That drive would have a file system on it, and SpinWrite might be low-level reformatting and/or extensively pattern testing the hard drive track containing the sectors of the file system to which SpinWrite was writing its log, because it's going through DOS and it has no control over where DOS writes the file. And that could be happening while it was working on the track underneath those file system sectors. And there might be a device driver lying about the size of the sectors and another one compressing those sectors so that they weren't even really sectors anymore, just elastic storage abstractions. So what does SpinWrite do? I virtualized access to the track that SpinWrite was working on. SpinWrite would read and, if necessary, recover all the data on a track, lifting it into a RAM-based track buffer. Then I would intercept any DOS and BIOS access which matched the current cylinder and head that I was working on, and would redirect those reads and writes to that pseudo track in SpinWrite's track buffer. In that way, it was possible for SpinWrite to write its log file through DOS, through whatever device drivers might be present and in the way, and to give DOS simultaneous access to the same track that SpinWrite was currently working on, reformatting, changing its sector interleave, and perhaps pattern testing for defects. And of course, yeah, the much easier solution would have been to simply tell SpinWrite's user that they cannot log to the same drive SpinWrite is running on. But since it was possible to engineer a way around that limitation, I had to do it. And SpinWrite does. Now, today, of course, all of that is, water under the bridge, over the dam, or something. The problem is all of that crap is still there, even though none of it is useful and none of it is doing anything any longer. And it's getting in the way because I'm having to constantly take all of that into consideration with everything I do, because the hooks, the tests, the double checks for all of those exception conditions are laced throughout the code. Today, sectors are only 512 bytes. They are never something else. Yet, I'm constantly multiplying or dividing by logical sectors per physical sector, or the logical sector size, which are two terms that's in SpinRite's code everywhere. And of course, on-the-fly compression is gone, and everything has become so much simpler simply by expanding everything's true addressability. Yet, all of the code for handling all of the kludges that predate today's relative simplicity remain functional and in the way. And of course, there's SpinRite's current limitation. As we know, 32 bits is about 4.3 billion. You know, it's the number of IPv4 addresses on the internet. And notice that 32 bits was no longer enough for the internet either. Well, it's no longer enough for our mass storage. If we take 4.3 billion 32 bits as a sector count, and we multiply it by 512 bytes per sector, that brings us to 2.2 terabytes, the absolute maximum size of any drive whose sectors can be accessed with 32 bits. To get around that, as I already have with the new drivers in the read speed benchmark, which SpinRite will be inheriting, all of the rest of SpinRite needs to have its sector addressing expanded from 32, well, I'm going to go to 64, although it currently it's 48. The current state of the art in the ATAPB spec for all of our state of the art drives is 48 bits of sector addressing, which, you know, up from 32, that's going to hold us for a long time, because that's 16 bits more. So it's 64K times 2.2 terabytes. So yeah, that ought to be enough for a while. Anyway, I'm going to be, for the sake of convenience in code, I'll go to 64, so twice 32. But all of the existing data structures and all the code that operates upon them needs to change. And that's not a problem, but all of the old crap code that serves absolutely no purpose any longer would also need to be changed if I was going to drag it along or simply be removed forever. My one goal, and of course, the hint is the title of this podcast, Out with the Old. My one goal is to get SpinRite 6.1 out the door in the shortest possible time. The more I think about it, the more I'm sure that saying goodbye to all of that crap, which I once labored over and loved, it was kind of fun looking at it in the last week, but is the way to go. What this essentially means is that SpinRite 6.1's users are going to wind up receiving a much newer and updated solution, more than just strapping these new drivers onto the existing aging code. And another problem is that SpinRite's traditional one track at a time approach is deeply embedded throughout the code. I mean, that's SpinRite was born as a one track at a time sector reinterleaving tool. And as I've said before, the reason it does data recovery is I realized if I'm going to low-level reformat a track with and move the physical sectors around to different positions in order to improve the system's performance, I only have that one last time to get the data off the track. So I built the best data recovery that I knew how to build. And of course, that ends up being SpinRite's claim to fame still today, even though, you know, it's been decades since any low-level formatting was actually possible on hard drives. They're all one-to-one interleaved, and they manage sector defects on their own. So despite that fact, even SpinRite 6 still deals with single tracks at a time. So that has to go out the window also. As we know, SpinRite's primary deliverables will be that it will once again be able to operate upon drives of any size, meaning 48 bits worth of sectors, yes, 64K times 2.2 terabytes, and that it will do so with all possible speed. I cannot issue track size operations to drives to get them to run at maximum performance. That's too much per command overhead relative to how fast today's drives are. I need to be transferring the maximum 32,000 sectors at a time. And wait a minute, 32,000. Okay, so that is, I am transferring half of what used to be DOS 3.3's maximum partition size per transfer in the new read speed benchmark. And that's what I'll be doing with SpinRite. So, and of course, all of SpinRite's data recovery has always operated upon exactly one physical sector at a time. But this too needs to be rethought in the era of drives, which use larger actual physical sectors. Logically, they still say sectors are 512 bytes. That has never changed. But we know that that modern drives often actually do have 4096 byte sectors. So, and SSDs are well known to be storing their data in memory pages, which are multiples of many physical sectors. So all of that needs to get fixed. And of course, we then have the future. If this was to be SpinRite's final dying gasp, the goal would be to just make it work and be done with it. But all evidence is that we are at the start, I think, of a significant renaissance for SpinRite. We've learned that today's mass storage engineers have been up to all manner of shenanigans with the focus of designing products so that only a tolerable percentage will fail before their warranty period has lapsed, and also that any data loss will go unnoticed. This is not to say that these products do not deliver stunning performance and capacity. They do. I feel my age by when I think about how large today's drives are, mm-hmm. and how inexpensive they are. Mm-hmm. But the nature of economics has always driven any designs and their designers to squeeze out every last possible drop of performance and capacity, while regarding some failure as inevitable and tolerable, even if that's never what any purchaser feels. When warranties only refer to the device's functioning, never to the user's data. So my point is, all of that old code in SpinRite has no future. And we'll be able to get to a SpinRite 7 after SpinRite 6.1 or 6.2, whatever, if I am able to then take SpinRite's new and stripped down code and move it forward. But I cannot move it forward as is. It's just dragging far too much useless history along. So the conclusion I've reached is that I should remove all of the creaky old code, which is in the way during the sector addressing expansion from 32 to 48 bits, while dropping the equally creaky old cylinder head sector and track abstractions, and incorporate an awareness of true physical sector size into SpinRite's data recovery operations. And in the interest of getting this out the door, I will largely leave SpinRite's funky textual UI as is, which will deliver what everyone most wants, a blazing SpinRite that they can again use on drives of any size with performance that makes that truly practical. So anyway, when I opened SpinRite up, I began looking at what I was going to have to do. I thought, wow, I really have moved so far away, Leo, from, you know, the days of a 32 megabyte partition size limit, you know. And then I was seeing this logical to physical. I go, oh my God, remember on track that, like, you know, you'd use that to like set your system up in order to get a partition of a useful size. Wow.
It's amazing. It really is. It's kind of, you know, the thing is, SpinRite has been around for a long time. Most other programs don't have this kind of history. So, you know, yeah. You've been dealing with this since hard drives began. What's cool is you're entering the SSD era and being just as useful. I think that's really interesting myself.
Yeah. That's it's really got me revved up.
Good.
So I'm going to get Spinrite 6.1 out to everybody and then on to 7.
Good. Thank you, Steve. And I love it. Frankly, I love it that you're keeping the old text-based interface, because why not? Why not? You don't need drop shadows and 3D GUIs or anything. It gets everything done. I actually use a lot of, you know, they call it TUIs, textual user interfaces. I use a lot of TUI apps, and I think they're great. Nothing wrong with that. Saves you a lot of time.
In fact, I was just talking about that over in the Spinrite group. I'm sort of thinking, planning ahead where I'm going to go, and I like the idea of using the Windows PE, the pre-execution environment, because Microsoft allows it to be used for setup and recovery purposes. So it falls exactly within my usage. It doesn't have a shell, but and it will only run for 72 hours, three days. And so that's plenty of time with the new Spinrite.
Really?
Because it'll be able to do things in hours.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. I was going to be that much faster. That's fantastic.
Oh, Leo, it screams.
Wow. Well, soon you can go get a copy of Spinrite right now and a copy of this podcast. Get two things done. Kill two birds with one stone, as they say. Go to grc.com. Pick up Spinrite. When you buy 6.0 now, you're automatically buying an upgrade to 6.1. Plus, you get to participate in the testing as we get closer and closer to the release. grc.com. You also get 16 kilobit versions of this show, 64 kilobit versions of this show. Transcripts, which is great if you like to read along while you listen. That's all at grc.com, plus a lot of other stuff, all free. Steve's hangout. You can leave him feedback there at grc.com/feedback or on Twitter. He's at SGGRC, and you can DM him there. His DMs are open. So if you've got a question, a comment, a suggestion, a picture of the week. Always good to leave your Cheetos at SGGRC. We've got 64 kilobit audio plus video of the show at our website, twit.tv/SN is the actual direct link. There's a YouTube channel. There's also, probably the easiest thing to do is subscribe in your favorite podcast application, and that way you'll get it automatically. Beginning of the year means it's time for the annual Twit survey. We're taking a deep dive into who you are, what you like, what you don't like. It's helpful for us as we design shows, but it's also, frankly, helpful for us with advertisers. And that's our bread and butter at this point. That's what keeps us going. So if you'd like to help us out, shouldn't take too long. Don't answer any question you feel uncomfortable with. Just go to twit.tv/survey21, our 2021 Twit Survey. twit.tv/survey21. Steve, have a great week. Enjoy your rewatch of The Expanse. I'll enjoy my first watch, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah,
and mostly I'm enjoying being up to my elbows in Spinrite. As you said, it's been around for 40 years. It is, venerable. And when you
look at the code, do you like remember when you wrote that, or like what was going on when you wrote that? Is it? Do you have
no, you don't
have that, but no. You do when you look at it. You look at it and you know what's going on, right?
Yes, my coding style, fortunately, was already mature enough that right. I mean, I was leaving comment trails. Okay. I had comment blocks. I was and I've always been a believer in long variable names. So like nice. Everything sort of documents itself. So
you
won't find my code having a QZD constant or something.
No. Do you use a lot of macros? I know MASM supports
MASM supports macros, and I have a whole bunch. In fact, it's one of the things that made it difficult for me to open source my code, because I've got fully custom headers, fully custom macros, my own libraries, and all this stuff that I've built over time.
Yeah. But that speeds it up. It almost, you can make, I remember when I was doing assembly coding, if you have good macros, it's almost like high-level coding. You don't have to do moves and jumps as much because you know, you've got a macro that does it all. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Fun. I kind of miss those days. It was really fun. But Steve's on it. You know, that's the key. Steve's on it. We'll talk to you next week, Steve.
Okay, buddy. Bye.
If you like Android with a heavy dose of fun and entertainment, then you're going to love All About Android. It's me, Jason Howell, along with my co-hosts Ron Richards and Florence Ion. Every Tuesday, we discuss the news items that matter most, the hardware and devices that are running Android, and the apps that run on top of them. Plus, we answer your email each and every week. That's All About Android on twit.tv. Security.